This is the Inland Journal from Spokane Public Radio. I'm Doug Nadvornik. Dr. David Taubin came to Spokane last week to talk about what he terms as the opioid epidemic. Dr. Taubin is the chief of pain medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Opioids are those drugs prescribed by doctors to cover up pain. Millions have become addicted to them. Hundreds of thousands of Americans have died from opioid overdoses. Dr. Taubin says there are better ways to treat pain, but opioids have been the easy treatment for doctors and insurance companies. That, he says, is changing. Not only have opioids caused so much pain for families, he says they're also creating a major shift in the way doctors treat patients in pain. And we'll get to all of those things during the next several minutes. Dr. Taubin is on the phone with us now. Most of the stories we hear about these, the worst of the epidemic, are in places like Huntington, West Virginia, and small towns in Ohio, and Terre Haute, Indiana, and a lot of these Rust Belt places. Are there places in rural Washington, rural Idaho, rural Oregon that sort of, you know, rise to that level?
So actually, Spokane and Whitman County and Stevens County out here, they're about the same as King County in terms of the overdose death rates that are occurring. You know, Lincoln and Columbia are similar to the West Virginia and the Ohio rural areas. Ferry, Pendray, about in the middle. And interestingly, Adams and Franklin, just going over a map recently, are the state prize winners at having low opiate overdose rates. So there's some winners here, just like there is in the western part of the state. And it distributes to generally the least resourced, the most socioeconomically distressed populations.
I wanted to ask you about the effect on the prescription habits, not only of the new doctors that we're training, but also on doctors like you who have been around a little while. Is there sort of a sea change for physicians when it comes to how do we treat pain in this?
Absolutely. I'd say it's like it's a Scylla and Charybdis sea change, steering between two poles, one of which is the undertreatment of pain, which we confronted really in the late 80s and early 90s. And now the overtreatment with opioids, but yet still the undertreatment of pain, because pain is best treated without opioids. In fact, it's best treated without any of the pharmaceuticals that we use for them. It's way more complicated than a pill can solve because it involves the social environment that our patients live in, home, work, economic, community, and it involves their psychological state, which is shaped beginning at early childhood in terms of potentially living in a high-stress home life, abandonment, abuse, neglect, physical violence, sexual abuse, all these awful things, and that changes the way the brain behaves. Practices are changing, and the systems of care have to change. Us old-timers and even middle-career folks lived through an era when it was encouraged. In fact, people were disciplined if they didn't take care of pain, using as many opioids as it required. So there is a giant paradigm shift, and unfortunately, the people getting hit by this swinging pendulum are our patients. Providers who are saying, I don't want any part of this business. I'm just not going to take care of pain. Too tricky, too much of a problem, and it's produced, actually, I think, an ethical conundrum. We had someone from the area who made some calls to a bunch of clinics, and she reported, this is non-scientific, that 40% of the clinics, when she said, oh, I need to find a new doctor, what's your problem? I have a chronic pain problem. And 40% of the clinics said, we don't take care of chronic pain. And she said, where can I go? And she said, well, you just have to call another clinic. And that's an abomination to the spirit of medicine.
So do doctors feel under siege? Because after all, they've been doing what they were trained to do. They thought they had these great, you know, tools, and we find out that the tools aren't as great as we thought they were. Is that leading to a moral and ethical dilemma within your, you know, the profession of we don't know what to do anymore?
I like the word. I may quote you. It is a siege. It's a siege for a bunch of reasons, and this is the system problem. So one of the system problems early on was the fact that you couldn't find anyone who could deliver the social and psychological therapies and the physical rehabilitation, because insurance companies weren't willing to pay for it. They wanted quick outcomes. Back in my earlier career days, a month's worth of OxyContin, the cost, would cover an entire clinical treatment protocol for cognitive behavioral therapy, which has proven evidence of benefit, and it's durable. So instead, drug company said, oh, we'll just pay for the OxyContins. Meanwhile, Purdue was promoting OxyContin, $200 million a year in marketing, and they generated in this interval $35 billion between 1996 and 2007. And in 2007, they had a settlement for false marketing, and it cost them $630+ million in fines. So that's a 55 times return on investment. What a great deal. And now they're being sued by every state in the country. Spokane County just jumped in the suit, and it's going to be similar to the tobacco settlement.
Dr. David Taubman teaches medical students at the University of Washington. He says they're learning more about pain and how to treat it than most veteran physicians received.
I received exactly 0 hours of pain education when I was a medical student. That was back in the 70s. In the early 2000s, it was average across this country 7 hours. That sounds like a lot, but that's over 4 years. And when you look at those curriculum, it was mostly about addiction and opioids. It wasn't about treating pain correctly. So big changes are occurring in that. UW and our Gonzaga students are now getting up to 26 hours. National leaders, because we have to train the incoming workforce. The other problem is the poor primary care doc in the clinic got about 15 minutes. Half the visit you spend doing the required preventative medicine stuff. The other half the visit, you navigate the 7 other chronic conditions the patient's talking about. The other half the visit, you see it's going to come up to longer than a visit. And in fact, they have no time at all on the treadmill of production that's expected. So they are untrained, overwhelmed with a workload that they cannot manage, no resources to send the patients to, no organized policies. They were confused by experts who kept telling them, yeah, just give more opioids. Now they're trying to dig out. So the first thing they're doing is they're stopping digging. Some are bailing out. But the clinicians who we strive to have, and I certainly hope we're creating in the workforce, and the senior mid and late career physicians that I meet across the state, they're folks who really want to do the right thing. They're carrying a load and working with what we call these legacy folks, people that have been on high doses. They're not addicts. They've just been doing what they've been told, and now their carpet's being pulled out from under them. This is the sea change, the siege, as you described, that they feel. And some are just refusing to take care of these patients, and that can't be done. So we need to give them the tools to do it. We need to give them the training to accomplish it, and we need to give them the resources to the patients so they can afford the more complicated, ultimately far less expensive, but services that are frequently not covered by any insurer.
Dr. David Taubman is the chief of pain medicine for the University of Washington School of Medicine. He spoke last week in Spokane. The state of Idaho will undergo 2 significant leadership changes next year when Butch Otter and Raul Labrador leave their current offices. Otter is retiring after 3 terms as governor. Labrador hopes to replace him. He is leaving his seat after 4 terms in the U.S. House of Representatives. On May 15th, the state's primary election will whittle the slate of candidates for state and federal office. That's when Labrador will find out whether he'll spend most of the next 6 months continuing his bid for governor. This week, we'll hear a bit from the five major party candidates for governor who were invited to participate in Idaho public television debates this week. We'll begin with the Republicans. Lieutenant Governor Brad Little is the number two state elected official in Idaho and the strongest candidate for the status quo.
Today, Idaho is the envy of all the states. We lead the nation in job growth. We lead the nation in income growth. We're one of the most solvent states of all the states as far as debt.
Little says the challenge is to create the right conditions so the state's young people will want to stay in the state. One area where Little wants to push the status quo is in finding ways around the Affordable Care Act.
I want to go back to where we were before. We had the most affordable health care of all the 50 states. We had a functioning high-risk pool where we had great incentives for people to be personally responsible for their own health care and help have health savings accounts. I want to continue to increase the supply of medical professionals so that that helps out in that area.
Little says the state continues to negotiate with the federal government to find ways to offer lower-cost health insurance plans. He likes the relationship the state has with the Trump administration, for example, in finding ways to allow Idaho to have more influence in how federal lands within its borders are managed.
I couldn't be happier about the response of this administration to Idaho raising their hand and say, we can do that better. And I believe they're going to continue to do that.
While Little believes the state is going in the right direction, two of the other Republicans are pushing for change. One, Dr. Tommy Ahlquist, is an emergency room physician, property developer, and entrepreneur.
Our children, your children, deserve more than the status quo in Idaho. Education in Idaho is going to be a priority for us. We must and we will modernize education and connect Idaho kids to Idaho jobs.
Ahlquist believes the state needs to make changes in how it raises and spends money.
I think we need to be more competitive on our income tax. I think we need to spend our money better. There's nothing wrong with taxing our people and then investing that money properly, but we're not doing it right now. We need to change this tax code and make sure that we're making it as competitive, as flat, and as fair for families and small businesses in Idaho. And if we make every decision based on that, what's best for the small businesses and families, we will go far in our tax policy.
Ahlquist also advocates making changes to the health care system.
We have a system that used to be primary care centric and now it's hospital centric. We have a system now that has absolutely no transparency, none.
Ahlquist says doctors and consumers alike are unsure about how much people will pay for specific health care procedures. Ahlquist and Raul Labrador have clashed over political ads from an organization that questions, among other things, Labrador's effectiveness in Congress. Labrador has countered by saying he's the true consistent conservative in the race, and he claims Ahlquist changes his positions on issues based on his political reasons. But in some cases, they agree where changes should be made. Labrador also wants to reform the state tax system.
My plan, just to make clear, is to bring all tax rates to 5-5-5. I want to bring the tax rates for 5% corporate, 5% individual, and 5% sales tax. That will cost approximately about $1 billion to bring down the tax rates in the state of Idaho. But what I want to do is I want to look at the loopholes.
He says the state offers approximately $3 billion a year in tax loopholes. As governor, he says he would work with the legislature to determine which of those to eliminate in order to pay for the money lost due to tax rate changes. Labrador touted his work with House Republicans to repeal the Affordable Care Act. When the Senate refused to go along, he said he worked to give states extra authority.
We attached an amendment, my friends in the Freedom Caucus and I, attached an amendment to the Obamacare repeal that would have allowed the states to repeal Obamacare and get rid of some of the regulations that are required by Obamacare. The reason that they have not been successful is because Obamacare does not allow them to do that. My amendment would have allowed that, and we spent a lot of time working with President Trump, working with the administration to make sure that if the Congress wasn't going to do it, that we could do it. Unfortunately, the Senate failed to follow through on the things that we wanted to do.
Not surprisingly, the two Democrats chosen for the public television debate have different views on taxes and health care. A.J. Belukoff is a Boise businessman who's been running TV and web ads around the state for a few months. Belukoff lost to Butch Otter in the 2014 gubernatorial election.
When I travel the state, I haven't heard anybody asking for tax cuts. And in fact, studies show that most Idahoans feel our tax burden is about right. And the people that push the tax cut point to the income tax rates that are higher than our neighboring states. But that's looking at just a piece of the puzzle. If you look at the entire tax burden of not only income taxes, but sales tax, property tax, the different fees that we pay, Idaho has one of the lowest tax burdens in the entire United States.
Belukov says Idaho spent $29 million last year to cover health care costs for uninsured people. He supports a proposed initiative that would require the state to expand Medicaid that would ensure subsidized care is available to thousands more Idahoans, with the federal government picking up a vast majority of the cost. Belukov has been a member of the Boise School Board for 21 years and touts that as his qualification for improving the state's education system.
I'm proud to have helped set the policies that put in motion things that have made the Boise school districts the best in the state. And our four traditional high schools for 10 years in a row have been listed by the Washington Post as top high schools in America.
Belukov's opponent in the primary is former State Representative Paulette Jordan. She's a member of the Coeur d'Alene tribe who gave up her seat in the state house to run for governor. Jordan is the youngest person among the major candidates in the race, and she's calling for a new generation to take charge.
Idaho officials have been playing to special interests for far too long, for decades, in fact. And unfortunately, Idaho's Democrats have been running scared. But it's about time that we change that, because we have a new era, a bold new leadership, a chance to elect a leader with fresh new ideas. And in myself, representing our next generation of Idahoans who are fighting for a better way of life, to be more prosperous, more successful in our economy, have access to quality health care and the best world-class public education that we can provide.
Like Belukov, Jordan supports an expansion of Medicaid for low-income people, and she disagreed with the state's new tax cuts.
Much of that money, the $200 million, in fact, that we gave away, that could have been reinvested back into our educational system. So while I voted no, I would have presented opportunities to promote that those dollars being reinvested back into Idaho's homegrown communities.
Like Raul Labrador, Jordan says she would support a review of the state's tax exemptions as a way to relieve the tax burden on individual taxpayers. You can hear the full debates involving these candidates at the Idaho Public Television website, idahoptv.org. Next week on Inland Journal, we'll hear from some of the candidates in the race for Idaho's first congressional district seat, the position now held by Raul Labrador. Once in a while, we get the chance to talk with third-party candidates for major offices. Earlier this year, we met Eric Agnew, who entered Washington's 5th District congressional race as an independent. He has since left that race. And today, we meet Steve Hoffman. Hoffman is a maintenance technician at North Seattle Community College. He's a shop steward for his local office of the Washington Federation of State Employees. He's also a candidate for the U.S. Senate seat, now held by Democrat Maria Cantwell. Hoffman is representing the Freedom Socialist Party. One of his slogans is, "Turn the tables on the rich," and he's here in the studio with us. So socialism is one of those words that has so many different meanings to different people, and I think that's just the way it's been used over the years. How do you define socialism?
Well, the main thing is socialism is a thing where the workers are put in power to control the society, the government, and what's produced. And the decisions to produce things are based on what meets people's needs, not on what makes profits for corporations and rich people. So that's the basic thing of socialism. It should be very democratic.
So why is it not popular in the United States?
When the McCarthy era gave it a black name because, you know, they were scapegoating people because what they were really doing is attacking unions and attacking civil rights. But they, if they wanted to attack you, they called you a red, right? But that's where that song called "You Ain't Been Doing Nothing If You Ain't Been Called a Red," you know. And, of course, I think the Stalinist bureaucracy in the Soviet Union gave it a bad name. But democratic socialism is really what we're after.
Well, so there's, you know, you talked about it. So there's communism, there's democratic socialism, there's freedom socialism. Excuse me. There's national socialism, which was
the Nazi party. Yeah.
And so you can kind of understand why people get a little confused about what the meaning of socialism is.
Yeah, I think that the socialism has to be democratic, where workers run things democratically, and you elect people from the workplace and from your community, and they have. Right now, you have a democracy, but it's really billionaires call the shots because it takes so much money to run, and they pull the levers. And they can also blackmail people and say, we're going to move the jobs out of the town if you don't do what we do. And socialists would say, no, you're not going to take it out of town. We're going to take it over if you don't want to run it, you know.
You're talking about workers running things, but if capitalists are the ones who are owning that, why would they give the power to the workers?
This is when we get to what I am, a revolutionary socialist. We do have to recognize that working people create all the wealth and make everything run. And if we decide to stop making things run, then we now have the leverage. It's just that we've never united enough across our differences, or never realized our potential power enough to come together and exercise that kind of leverage. And that's what we haven't seen yet, is probably what the capitalists are afraid of.
So you used another word that has different meanings, revolutionary, as in revolutionary socialism. What does that mean?
What I mean is revolutionary versus reformist. A reformist, like when Bernie was describing his socialism, he said, well, and he was on, gave an interview, and he said, well, we're not talking about nationalizing the means of production here. And I thought, you know, when I talk about socialism, that is what I'm talking about. Because it's not going to work anyway, because you're going to leave too much power in the hands of the capitalists. So you do have to take the power, political power, and use it to take the economic power. A large movement, unified movement of the overwhelming majority of the working class. And we exercise our power through general strikes, through political action, through mass protest. And I suspect that the capitalists will react violently, and the workers will have the right to defend themselves. So I'm not a pacifist. I think the workers have a right to even use armed self-defense in that situation if that's what's necessary.
So in 2016, when Bernie Sanders ran as a democratic socialist, it sounds like you're lukewarm about Bernie Sanders.
I felt like he was pretty much sheepdogging for the Democratic Party. You know, he was just keeping all that movement within the Democratic Party. And then when he got kind of cheated out of the nomination, he decided to just toe the line and support Hillary Clinton. And then that disillusioned a lot of his followers, I think, or irritated them, I'm sure. But to me, the whole exercise was to keep people within the Democratic Party. When you do that, I just feel like you're providing a left quasi-socialist cover for a mainstream Democratic Party that is really pro-big business in its essence. And in almost everything that actually gets enacted, does the left wing of the Democratic Party, does their agenda ever get enacted? No. So they're just keeping people within a big business political party, which is not really a service to the working class.
Steve Hoffman of the Freedom Socialist Party is running for the U.S. Senate seat held by Democrat Maria Cantwell. Inland Journal is Spokane Public Radio's weekly public affairs program. Podcasts are available at the Inland Journal page of the Spokane Public Radio website, spokanepublicradio.org. You can send your comments to inlandjournal@kpbx.org, or you can call our listener comment line at 509-232-6904. The program is made possible through your contributions. Thank you for your support during our recently concluded pledge drive. I'm Doug Nadvornik.